This is the third part of a course. We've already covered the first and second foundations of mindfulness. For those of you who haven't heard those Dharma talks, you might want to just go on the website. It's both in text and audio for those talks. Most people look forward to this third foundation of mindfulness. I think it's probably is really the most interesting of the four foundations, because I think we kind of intuitively know that it's going to give us a look into the depths of the mind, where there are hidden forces that are lurking. It is fascinating. It can be scary, but it's also extremely beneficial to take a look at it. But it's hard to tell how much there is to mindfulness of mind by a quick reading of the sutta, because the mind doesn't even get a full page. In fact, it only gets two paragraphs. The first is a list of eight states of mind and their opposites. And the second paragraph contains the usual refrains about not clinging to anything and knowing each mind state, in this case, either internally or externally or both. This foundation instructs us simply to know if the mind is in one of these states or not. Of course, without clinging to it and looking at it from the outside as well as the inside. The list starts out even simpler than this instruction. If the mind is greedy, hateful, or deluded, then those are familiar as the three causes of suffering. And then to notice if each of those mind states is absent. And then the fourth item on the list is whether the mind is distracted or contracted, which Anallio says in his book Satipatthana means whether the mind is restless or dull. And you may be familiar with those two from the five hindrances, restlessness or sloth and torpor. According to many commentators, the final four states on the list relate to what's called the higher attainments that come from concentration practice, the jhanas. Other commentators say that those last four items relate to the progress toward full liberation that we've made in our practice. Either way, our attention is directed to the development of our practice and monitoring its growth. Now, it's rare for the four foundations of mindfulness to be taught these days right out of the sutta. The introduction to mindfulness courses kind of run alongside the four foundations. They start out with the body, usually with a week on the breath and a week on general awareness of the whole body. And then thoughts and emotions will be covered, maybe with a week each. And they're somewhat related to Vedana, or liking or not liking things. And the fifth week is often called mind, which in the course will cover mood, attitudes, assumptions, opinions, values, etc. And then the last week, if there is one, is daily life practice. So that kind of leaves out Dharma, which is the fourth foundation. When a Dharma talk covers the four foundations, it will usually run kind of alongside the sutta on the body and vedana, but then it veers away from the mind and possibly just skips the Dharma again, or give it a very general description, like seeing the Dharma in our experience. With this course, my goal was to reveal the teachings that are in the sutta and make them relevant to lay people's lives. And, you know, that's what the courses and the Dharma talks are trying to do also. The fact is that the sutta presents some fairly esoteric ideas. With the Dharma, I forget at the moment how many lists there are. It would make for a very long Dharma talk to cover them all. And I don't expect to be doing that next time either. What all these approaches have in common, from the sutta to a half-hour Dharma talk, is a way to depersonalize the mind by paying close and immediate attention to the actual experience of mental states. Doing this at all requires that we develop what I call unguarded awareness, or allowing whatever enters our awareness to come into focus without our reactively hiding it or judging it. And this ability of unguarded awareness, I think, is best developed with a large and intentional dose of metta for ourselves. It's like a horse whisperer saying over and over, "It's okay. You're okay. Don't be afraid of seeing this." Anallio says that we need to make ourselves receptive to how mental activities are actually experienced, quote, "because of one's instinctive tendency to ignore whatever contradicts or threatens one's sense of importance and personal integrity." In other words, there's a lot of stuff that enters the mind that conflicts with our ego ideal. I've seen this in myself and in a lot of other people. We use distraction, denial, and alternative realities or lies to avoid seeing mental activities that clash with how we want to see ourselves. And this is how we suppress unwanted thoughts or emotions. And we usually do this unconsciously and unintentionally. In contrast, when we use wise effort to redirect our thinking from thoughts that lead to suffering, that's not suppression, because we can do that only after we consciously recognize and acknowledge those thoughts in the first place. So suppression is this sort of automatic, unconscious hiding from states of mind that have arisen. And we can't use wise effort unconsciously. We have to do it intentionally. And we have to know what we're working with in order to do it. When I began my practice decades ago, I found it very helpful to hear that I am not my thoughts and they are not mine. I recently repeated this in another Sangha, and someone asked, well, then whose thoughts are they? And the answer is really simple. They aren't anybody's. The brain is like that machine that chucks out tennis balls so you can practice your swing, or a bubble machine. You know, its job is just to offer up thoughts out of the depths of our unconscious in case any of them are useful. Some thoughts are good ideas. Possibly they're the solution we've been looking for. Others are real stinkers that should not be given any more attention than it takes to recognize them. And a lot of thoughts are just silly. Some are mere fragments of thought that drift around our consciousness like background noise or litter blowing in the wind. The idea that we are the sum total of our thoughts is not just wrong, it's insulting, since so many of our thoughts are nonsense. One of my first writing teachers back in high school taught us that creativity is not the art of having good ideas, but of recognizing them. We need to be able to see and assess our thoughts to avoid writing drivel or acting on foolish notions. Identifying with our mental activity is like getting all tangled up in a sticky web, so our range of thinking is progressively contracted. It can lead to a lot of anxiety, too, because our sense of reality then is constantly challenged by conflicting experience. It's so much easier just to recognize that thoughts simply float into our awareness. If we give them no attention, they just float away. This is the great benefit of intentionally focusing our attention on a single object for a fair amount of time. We actually see this happen. We haven't chosen to think these thoughts that come up and take our attention away from what we meant to concentrate on. In fact, we've made a conscious decision not to, but still they happen. No one invited them to occur, so there's no one to blame for them. Most people say that when they settle into a fairly deep state of concentration, they can observe thoughts arising and float around like bits of debris and then pass out of their awareness. Those thoughts won't stick to the mind because when we're deeply concentrated on one thing, we're not thinking about ourselves. So no me, no problem. And that's the nature of all mental events, including the moods that we wake up in or fall into during the day. The mind can serve up all the stored mental actions that we have made in the past, either consciously or unconsciously, like assumptions, values, opinions, beliefs, etc. These mind states have been a part of our mental baggage, possibly for a really long time. But they were generated in the same way as the thoughts we're thinking now, by the mechanics of our nervous system interacting with the environment. There may have been some conscious activity at various points in the development of our mental habits, but this is a new moment, and that old baggage doesn't need to determine the present or the future anymore. When we recognize an old opinion arising and prompting us toward a certain response to whatever event has just happened, then we have an opportunity to reevaluate that opinion. Is it still valid? In these circumstances, what is the best thing to do? Maybe there's a fallback mood that dominates many of our days. Being able to just notice, that same mood is back, provides space to decide to look at things differently. Whatever it is that we're telling ourselves when we're in a particular mood, maybe we can tell ourselves something else. Maybe we can focus on different factors in this situation. So I'm not talking about eureka moments that instantly transform our lives, but these moments of seeing what the mind is up to that give us clarity, they do often have a touch of exhilaration when we see the possibility of freedom that they're offering. Seeing how the mind works can be profoundly liberating. Recently, I heard myself speaking in a voice that I recognized from my professional life when I was the boss. And it took a few minutes for me to realize where that voice came from and how inappropriate it was under the circumstances. I couldn't do it right away, but recognizing the state of mind that had caused that voice gave me a chance to apologize and explain that there was a ghost from the past that had been using my mouth. And now that I have that ghost's number, it might not be able to hijack my behavior again. In Touching the Infinite, Rodney Smith says that the Satipatthana Sutta points us toward the realization that everything, including our sense of self, is empty of independent reality. Our bodies, as we saw in the first foundation, are bits of this and pieces of that. Our responses to events, our likes and dislikes or vedana, are dependent on the moment in which they arise. You probably have noticed that you like one thing at one time, and in other circumstances, maybe you like it. Vegetables that I never wanted to eat tasted pretty good at Chez Panisse. Anything we point to in our mental experience is equally impermanent without any substance of its own. Every impression we have of solid continuity is an illusion, a trick of the mind from which we can free ourselves by simply not believing it anymore. And that's easier said than done. If the mind hasn't been preconditioned and made ready to see this truth, because the delusions we cling to are very powerful. It feels like the threat of death to let these illusions go. So if we're not there yet, if all my reasonable words and similes and Anallio's translations of Pali and all other teachers' explanations haven't softened up your mental habits, then the Satipatthana Sutta has another way to approach the problem. It says, just watch. The Sutta takes a very simple, pragmatic, show-me approach. It takes four mental states that trap us in suffering, and four that set us free. And it sets us the task of noticing them arise and depart so we can know their nature as impermanent. We're told to spend time being on the lookout for this short list of mental states and for the moments when they're not present. Doing this practice leads to the direct experience of anatta, seeing for ourselves that mental events are empty of any of their own being, whether or not that was our goal. This practice lets us see emptiness and the realization that can set us free. What the Satipatthana Sutta tells us to observe is wanting stuff or greed, 2, not wanting or hatred, 3, delusion, and 4, restlessness or dullness. These states of mind just need to be observed according to the refrains repeated so often in the suttas, internally or externally, or both, or free of clinging to them, or to anything. So we acknowledge externally the mind is occupied by thoughts or emotions that are forms of desire or of aversion or delusion, or the mind is restless or dull. And we let ourselves experience this internally by observing how it feels, whether it's pleasant or not, and observe how it affects other mental states. And we let go of the clinging that can hold us trapped in these mind states so they can just pass away. So we're keeping a lookout for these mind states, getting to know their true nature, and developing the habit of freeing ourselves from them. So without using reason or similes, we come to understand as a result of this knowing that these states of mind are not me or mine, that they have no substance of their own. There's nothing personal to them. So there's nothing to be embarrassed about when we feel a yearning for something, or a distaste, a fear, or when we fall asleep meditating. It's just sloth and torpor. Or when the mind spaces out or jumps around like a grasshopper. Or when we realize that we've been deluded, telling ourselves an old story that just isn't true now. Recognizing these mind states for what they are really undercuts our clinging to them so that they'll just dissolve. Now, there are several ways that this process of depersonalization is helpful, not the least of which is that we don't get ego attached to our practice in either its tribulations or its successes. The next four states of mind on the suttas list are often called, as I mentioned before, higher attainments, which even sounds like an invitation to be vain about them. When the mind sees calmly and clearly, or when it's concentrated or liberated, this practice lets us recognize that even these refined states of mind aren't a quality of me or mine. And that keeps us humble. The last thing we want to do is ego trip on the spiritual practice that we've made. Another purpose in observing these last four mind states in the sutta is to know how our practice is going. Just when you're hiking in the woods or driving around a city, you need to know where you are in order to find your way to where you want to go. And wherever we are in our practice, it's really valuable to work with this third foundation. Getting to know what I call the geography of the mind gives us a lot of freedom and options that keep us from being blindly pushed around by whatever seizes our attention in the moment. The main point of this short foundation is to just look into the mind, maybe formerly called your mind, like snorkelers putting their masks under the water to see the fish swimming by. And having a list of what to look for helps enormously. I mean, we can make up our own lists. But the first short list of four troublesome states of mind, it's a pretty good place to start because they actually cover just about everything that causes us suffering. Every bit of relief from self-attachment that my practice has brought me has made life better and taken my practice deeper. So I wish you all happy snorkeling. Thank you.